In Phoenix, the heat's a fact of life. This weekend, it's awful. Today's high, 111 degrees. Tomorrow, the prediction is 114, just 2 degrees short of the all-time record. Now, this weather's tough on people who air condition their homes, but for those who live on the streets, it can be deadly. From member station KJZZ, Peter O'Dowd has our story.
It's not even lunchtime, and already a thermometer reads 104 degrees. A few dozen people wait outside this center for the homeless in downtown Phoenix, vying for every scrap of shade on the lot. As one visitor put it, this city is hotter than three hells.
It can be quite disturbing, especially if you don't have some kind of living quarters.
Herman Sheffield is a big man with a big smile. He holds a bottle of water in his hand and says each night before he goes to sleep outside, he prays to God for relief.
The good Lord been kind of like watching over me. Because about 10, 11 o'clock, it get a little breezy. We get a little wind.
In this weather, every blessing counts. Those who live in it say the heat makes them irritable, disoriented, and unable to eat. The constant sun, they say, is a giver of near-constant headaches. Even at night, the temperature can hover in the lower 90s.
Out here, it's war, basically.
Kevin Walton lived on the streets for 3 months after his wife died. Before he found a job at the nearby shelter, he slept in the parking lot waiting for a spot to open inside.
Your body is going to shut down by itself sometimes. Like, you know what, this is enough, sit down, you're out. You get back up, but you're in the same thing. You know, you're still too hot. I mean, you've got to have a real sense of survival when you're out here, because if you don't, then you're not going to last.
It's not unusual every summer for dozens of people to die from heat exposure in the Phoenix area. In 2002, one of the hottest years of the last decade, more than 100 perished in the sun. Just last week, Richard Chamberlain says he saw a man who died on the street, likely the third heat-related death of this summer.
When I walked out there, I seen him foaming at his mouth. His chest wasn't rising or falling. I knew right away that he had passed on. So that's the reality of being homeless. You know, you're subjected to this.
Outreach workers say the man was wearing several layers of winter clothing when he died. It's a common problem for the homeless who are mentally ill, according to Ken Curry, who runs one of the programs here. He says he often finds people dressed for a blizzard in the desert, in part because the medication they're taking doesn't mix with the heat.
If you're 100% healthy, you're at risk. The ones who are less than optimal health are really at risk.
Some of the homeless here say they're constantly haunted by fears of dying outside. For others, like Tally McCoy, who juggled illness and insects and blinding heat on the streets for 6 months, death seemed better than what she was enduring.
You become fearless. Death is like, that's a pleasure. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, come on, I welcome death.
Back outside, Herman Sheffield, the man with the big smile, is considering his future in Phoenix. He's from Atlanta, and this weather doesn't suit him. When his disability check arrives in August, he'll head north.
Hopefully, I should be gone by the first.
So as soon as you get that check, you're heading up to cooler climates.
Oh, the nearest plane getting out of here. I'm going plane style.
Before Sheffield boards a plane for Reno, he must endure Phoenix in July, the sweatiest and most lethal month of the year. For NPR News, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Obama's been on the road this week. Russia, Europe, Africa. Well, here at home, there's political surprises and scandals to keep politics bubbling. NPR Senior News Analyst Dan Shore joins us now. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And as we note, the president was in motion this week. Russia, Italy, Vatican City. He's now in Ghana. Let's go through some of the highlights, if we could, and start with Russia. The president said he wanted to reset that relationship.
Yeah, right. And so they announced at the end with great triumph that they'd reached a very important tentative agreement to further reduce the nuclear arsenals on both sides. And that was supposed to be the great result of the meeting with Medvedev. Mm-hmm. Now what's happened is Medvedev is now in L'Aquila in Italy, where they've had the summit of the eight. And there he says, oh, yeah, Yeah. Only, however, if the United States gives up its plans for an anti-missile defense in Poland and the Czech Republic. That sort of torpedoes what was supposed to be the big deal and puts American-Russian relations where they usually are, questionable.
Mm. And let me ask about climate change and the G8, because the president had hoped to get some commitments there.
And when it comes to climate change for the G8, first of all, you get countries which are emerging and really need to poison the atmosphere in order to industrialize. And they're very loath to give it up. And they say, why don't you start first? And so they come out with, maybe we'll have not more than this by this time, and they set little dates when things are supposed to happen, but they don't really take you very far. Not very much has happened. I must say, if anything more concrete happened at this summit, it was an agreement to use about $20 billion in seeds and helping emerging countries in order to get their own food supply. There's something so much more concrete about money for seeds than maybe in the blue sky we're going to solve the climate problem.
President Obama met with Pope Benedict on Friday. There were some areas of agreement and some areas where the Pope clearly wanted to change the president's thinking.
Yes, well, they met for just about a half hour, and you got more or less what you would expect from a meeting like that. When it comes to arms control, when it comes to help for the poor, they were very much together. Then, of course, the question of abortion was raised, as it had to be raised, and, of course, the Pope and our president don't agree on abortion. So, no harm done, probably.
President Obama is visiting Africa on this trip. Why did he choose to go to Ghana?
Yes, very, very interesting. He chose as the place he wanted to go to Ghana, and he said that he considers Ghana to be a model for a working democracy in Africa. He didn't say anything, however, about Kenya, which is where his ancestors come from, but which is mired in corruption. And so I think he had a message to transmit that there are good countries in Africa, but even my country in Africa is not so good.
When the president returns home, he's coming back to low consumer confidence, according to the polls,
right,
and increasing criticism of the stimulus plan. Where's the money gone? Why isn't it having more effect? Do we need more?
Well, that's right. It's a very impatient country, and nobody's more impatient than politicians. And they gave all that money for stimulus. They want to see stimulus. If the unemployment rates are still going up, which they are, then stimulus doesn't stimulate enough. Now, the fact is, no one ever really expected that they could, within the first 6 months, make this thing turn around, unemployment and recession situation, which has been years in building, but they do tend to be rather impatient. So you get two sides. One is, A, maybe we need more stimulus, and then maybe we need less stimulus. And so they manage to get a good argument going, but you don't see anything concrete coming out of all of this that indicates any answer to all these questions.
A lot of flares in the political world this week between Roland Burris saying he's not going to be running for re-election, continuing interest in Governor Palin, more revelations, I think it's safe to say, about the affairs, literally, of Senator John Ensign. Can I get you to talk about Robert McNamara?
Yes, you can talk about
him. Who died this week, former Secretary of Defense, and must be said, president of Ford Motor Company before that, one of the original whiz kids.
He walked out on that because he was invited by President Kennedy to come in and make the Pentagon work more efficiently. He was essentially a good manager. He apparently wasn't a great philosopher. He didn't understand very much about the Vietnam War, and so he had the Vietnam War around his neck. And he became sort of the architect of war in Vietnam. Well, as I knew him, he was very unhappy about that. And he wrote a book to try to explain it. And it was almost like an apology. It was short of an apology. And then he just went to the World Bank because he wanted to do a thing for helping poor countries and all. He tried to live down the Vietnam War, knowing in his own mind that he never succeeded.
And what do you make of the newest dust-up between, I think we can say, Speaker Pelosi, the CIA, and Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA?
What I make of it is there are constantly problems that arise over the years in which the CIA thinks there's things it has to do and doesn't want Congress to know because then it will leak, and then if it leaks, it's going to be very bad for everybody. The result, however, is that they then are called on the carpet and say, you know, we have oversight rights and powers here. We're supposed to do this thing. And so it appears that there's a program, and they will not even say what the program is, that was initiated shortly after 9/11. probably involved something about apprehending terrorists and how to get them, and then what you do with them after you get them, probably, but they will not say. And it is one of these things which continue to be a sore point between Congress and the CIA and the whole administration, for that matter, but it'll come and it'll go.
Dan, thanks very much.
Sure thing.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Coming up, we go to the Bronx. California, however, is running out of money while lawmakers there battle over the budget, and as a result, the state's been paying some of its bills with IOUs. But now, there's another problem. Most major national banks no longer accept those IOUs. They contend they're just trying to help the state fix its budget mess. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
The big banks warned that they'd take the IOUs only through midnight last night, and they've stuck to that deadline. Neither Wells Fargo nor Bank of America would talk about the decision on tape, but their spokesman said the decision was meant to pressure the state to solve the budget impasse. Jennifer Westerman of Bank of America says if her bank kept accepting IOUs, it might, in her words, deter the state from reaching a budget agreement. In California, that explanation has encountered some skepticism.
That's a bunch of bulls from the banks, just as good reason as any. You know, because they don't want them.
Howard Winderbaum supplies food to California prisons, and he just received his first IOU. It's a payment for some chili his company delivered in May to a prison on lockdown. Winderbaum's bank will take the IOU, but it's going to put a 5-day hold on the money while it verifies whether the IOU is legit.
They feel forgery is going to run rampant with these IOUs. Rampant. Because I'm looking at this thing. I mean, yeah, it looks like a check, but I'm sure, I assume, there's watermarks in it somewhere, but it looks like a basic check. So they fear the banking industry, there's going to be a tremendous amount of fraud and forgery.
Winderbaum is just grateful that he's dealing with a small local bank where he can still redeem the IOUs. As to the big banks, he doubts their refusal to take them will have any effect on the budget battle. But State Senator Mark Leno is more optimistic. He says the last time the state had to issue IOUs, the banks were the ones that broke the budget logjam.
The IOUs came to an end in 92, also when the banks said, sorry, state government, we are not going to be your codependents in this. We're not going to accept your IOUs any longer.
Meanwhile, some other financial institutions smell an opportunity. The trade group for California's credit unions is now calling attention to the fact that many of its members will still accept IOUs, in some cases, even from new customers. Martin Costi, NPR News.
One of the toughest places for intelligence officers to penetrate is North Korea. The hermetic communist country allows few Westerners across its borders. Those who enter legally are kept on a short leash, with minders watching every move. And for others, well, there's the case of Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, two American journalists sentenced to 12 years hard labor for allegedly crossing into North Korea illegally. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was asked about the journalists yesterday.
What we hope for now is that these two young women would be granted amnesty through the North Korean system and be allowed to return home to their families as soon as possible.
Another journalist, Thomas Van Hootriva, has been in and out of North Korea twice. He's captured rare images of everyday life there, and he got in by joining a visiting business delegation.
And in order to do that, I had to completely mask the fact that I'm a photojournalist.
So you had to pretend like you were a businessman. And what were you?
I was a consultant in the chocolate business. Basically, North Korea has no chocolate production and no major chocolate importation, and it was sort of an in that I could get in, and chocolate is also a fairly innocent thing.
Hmm. And so you just sort of went on your U.S. passport with this delegation, and it was as simple as that?
No, I'm actually a dual national. I have a European passport, uh-huh, too, and I went in with that one.
Presumably, the North Korean authorities could do a Google search or could easily find your photographs online. Were you ever concerned that they would find you out?
Yeah, there are a lot of published photos of mine on the internet that are linked to my name. I actually did a very, very small misspelling of my name just by combining two. My last name is a two-worded last name, and I made it into one. And then I put up false websites indexed to that name, and I waited until the Google search had them at the top before I applied for my North Korean visa.
So you land in North Korea as a consultant to the chocolate-making industry. And how do you sort of begin to take photographs? I mean, it would be a bit unusual for a chocolate man to carry around a good camera and start snapping professional photos.
Right. I had to be very, very discreet. I just couldn't behave like a professional photographer. I couldn't, you know, wait for a nice light or get down on one knee, all the things that a photographer normally does. I had to be very, very discreet and choose which shots I wanted to take very, very carefully.
Some of these pictures are amazingly candid. There's a photo of people pressed against a rainy bus window, sort of fogging up, and a woman in what appears to be a hospital bed. They're not normal tourist snapshots by any means. How did you get access to these places? How are you able to take these photos?
That was the advantage of being on these delegations, is we visited schools, hospitals, factories, all kinds of sites in Pyongyang that had never been visited before by foreign photographers. A lot of it was staging. There's even a word in Russian for this kind of staging. Whenever a foreign visitor or a high party official comes through, they put on a show to make everything look better than it is. The Russians call this word pokazuha. And we were paraded through one model school or one model hospital after another. So it was very hard to tell, were we seeing the real North Korea or were we seeing the North Korea that they want these delegations to see?
They were showing you the best of North Korea, essentially.
Of course.
And, I mean, in terms of the photographs, was any suspicion cast on what you were doing?
Yeah. A few days after I had first arrived on the first trip, they said nothing to me for 2 days, and they kind of watched me work. And since they said nothing to me, I let my guard down a little bit and began to take photos in a way that a tourist wouldn't take them. And eventually on the second evening that I was there, they pulled me aside. They questioned me for 4 hours. They questioned me about what my real employment was. They made me take my digital memory cards out. They made me look through photos, and they made me delete them. But unbeknownst to them, I had a system where I was secretly hiding the photos. So I had a kind of MP3 player with a card reader in my room. And each day during lunch or each day after the end of our excursions, I would go into the bathroom and secretly transfer the files from my memory cards onto this MP3 player. So when I had to later delete them from the memory card, I had a backup. So I never lost a single photo.
As we mentioned earlier, two American journalists have been sentenced to 12 years in prison for allegedly trying to sneak into North Korea without a permit. Did you hear that story and sort of have any pause that maybe that could have been you?
Yeah, you know, even while I was there, like I said, I'm a dual national and I had two passports. And because of a small technical problem getting a Chinese visa, I ended up traveling with both passports with me. And on one of the trips, they came very, very, very close to discovering my American passport. And when that story came out about the horrible verdict that these two American journalists were given, I really thought, had they discovered my passport, would I have been put into a similar situation? And it just hits me a little bit too close to home, as you can imagine.
Tomas Van Hootreve is a documentary photographer who's visited North Korea twice. You can see some of his pictures from those visits at our website, npr.org. Mr. Van Hootreve, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now, for most of us, the state of the moon won't have much effect on how our evenings go tonight. But on a recent night on the shore of the Delaware Bay, a full moon was a signal to start a really wild beach party. It's a party that's been taking place for millions of years. And for Louisa Jonas of WYPR in Baltimore, it's one of the highlights of the season. Here she is with the first of two reports from the water's edge.
I want you to imagine you're stepping back in time, say 400 million years. We're talking before the dinosaurs, before flying insects even. Now, imagine you've morphed into a female horseshoe crab. You spend most of your time trudging along the bottom of the ocean, but tonight will be your night to remember. You're swimming to the shore, which you only do for a few weeks a year. Along the way, you meet that special someone, and he clasps onto the back of your shell. You and your mate crawl onto the beach, where you'll spawn at high tide under the light of the full moon. And you're not alone. Thousands of other horseshoe crabs are piling on top of one another. Your glistening shells cover the beach for miles. And because you're female, you're in for a treat. The mate attached to your shell is not your only tryst. Tonight, you will mate with up to 12 or 13 males, all at the same time.
Come with me, my love, to the sea of love.
Oh, you want to get a party? I'm going to take
it. Fast forward to the 21st century AD. It's three nights before the full moon. As a horseshoe crab, you haven't changed much. Dinosaurs may have grown wings and turned into birds. You haven't really needed to evolve. A master generalist, you've survived asteroids, volcanoes, and ice ages. Scientists call you a living fossil. And, like your ancestors, you know where to find a few willing companions this evening. The Delaware Bay shore is the site of the largest horseshoe crab spawning in the world. And tonight, you have some human visitors.
My name is Jordan Rutter, and I'm from Silver Spring, Maryland.
I'm Keith Rutter.
I'm Erin Rutter.
I'm Pam Rutter, and I'm from Silver Spring, too.
We just love the whole phenomena of how once a year, or you know, for a season, the horseshoe crabs do this incredible mating on the beach. I don't know how anybody can watch this and not get excited about, you know, just nature and science and how things work in the world.
But the Rutters didn't travel to Pickering Beach, Delaware, just to watch. They came here to count. In the 1990s, the horseshoe crab population in the bay plummeted. So tonight, at the world's epicenter of horseshoe crab sex, volunteers in headlamps and waiters will tally up the amorous crabs.
If the untrained observer, if you didn't know about horseshoe crabs, and you just walked up on this beach right now, and you looked out along the shoreline, you would just think they were shiny stones, thousands of shiny stones, and it looks like you could walk the whole length of this beach, stepping from stone to stone. They're that thick. But when you stop and think that they're horseshoe crabs, and how many thousands of years, millions of years, that they've been doing the same ritual, it, you know, can't help but touch you.
At first glance, it's hard to get sentimental about a horseshoe crab. Horseshoe crabs are weird. They're like armadillos of the sea. Their shells look like armored helmets, and their tails resemble swords. Then, consider their eyes. They have 10 of them, including one on that spiked tail that helps them tell time. And there's no such thing as safe sex here. About 10% of crabs die upside down when they can't right themselves during spawning. Stu Mickles is a fishery scientist from Delaware Division of Fish and Wildlife. He's leading tonight's survey. Stu admires a single pile of crabs.
Okay, what we have is a congregation of spawning horseshoe crabs. There's a number of males on top surrounding a female who is buried into about 10 centimeters in depth. Attached to her rear is a single male, and he can fertilize the eggs exclusively if there's no other males around. However, there's lots of males on this beach right now, and they're all competing to reproduce with the female. And they will also emit milk and fertilize a portion of her eggs tonight.
In one sitting, each female lays about 4,000 tiny green eggs that look like clumps of pesto in the sand. In a few weeks, only the luckiest of eggs will hatch, and billions of eraser-sized horseshoe crab babies will wash into the bay. At exactly 9:04, high tide on Pickering Beach tonight, the teams get to work. Jordan, the eldest Rutter daughter, thrusts her French-tip manicured fingers into the foamy surf. She gropes the spawning crabs in a 1-square-meter grid, distinguishing males from females.
So I counted 4 females, and then I counted 13, okay, plus the ones you threw out.
It's not so easy to determine males. Who's who in the breaking waves, females, with the crabs sometimes 3 layers female, deep. But the Rutters move fast. They have to cover 1 kilometer of beach before the tide recedes and the creatures disappear back into the water. Pam says she and Keith have been bringing their daughters to Delaware to count spawning horseshoe crabs since the girls were small.
You feel like you're part of the bigger world here. You know, it's pitch dark right now, and all this is happening, and it's just, it's pretty amazing. Look at them.
By sunrise, most of the crabs will have vanished. But if it's been a successful spawn, so many eggs will cover the sand that the shore for miles will shine emerald green. Recent surveys suggest that the horseshoe crab population may be stabilizing. And everyone here hopes this latest count will show an increase in spawning. The crabs themselves are certainly doing what they can. Even after the tide recedes, taking most of the females with it, a few determined solitary males still patrol the beach, scanning the deserted sand for a mate. For NPR News, this is Louisa Jonas.
Tomorrow, Louisa explores how this annual crab orgy is key to the fate of a small, cinnamon-colored shorebird. And if you go to our website, you can see pictures of the crabs and birds and hear more about the efforts to conserve them.